With thorns it was covered, with weeds overgrown. The stone wall around it had been overthrown. I saw in my mind, and its warning I took as precious instruction received from a book. And that, little children, was Proverbs chapter 24, verses 31 and 32 from 2004. The version of Yours Truly. Continuing our study of the article Trojan War, we're in chapter 9, paragraph 12 now. And this was an article written in 2015, by the way, at the end of 2015. Last, we read the banishment, Stila, this is the end of chapter 9, refers to a feast of Ammon, quote, at the new year, end quote, and states that it was also the, quote, fifth day of the, in brackets, feast, end quote. Miss Tetley arguing with us that the feast began on the second epagamenal day, the fifth epagamenal day being the fourth of the feast, and the last day of the year. This is the entry. That was from page 469 of Christine Tetley's 2014 book. This entry on the banishment stela is the entry with the short missing year number, which followed a year 25, agreeably smendes. We discussed that. And the argument of Miss Tetley on page 469 is, of her book, that is that Amenemnisu did succeed Smendes directly and ruled 4 years, meaning circumstances favored Amenemnisu, as Kitchen stated. In other words, the circumstances of this inscription, which referred to a feast at the new year, and with a short year number, in other words, a year number that was year five or less, because if you write longer numbers in the Egyptian language, it turns out, or higher than five, it requires more space on the stela where they made the inscription. So it was believed it was a short year number, something like 1 to 5 or something like that, but maybe they knew that it was not year one. Possibly they knew that because it would be even shorter, because one stroke would be the year one, and five strokes is year five. But all they said was that it was a short year number. When we are, and of course Kitchen agreed that short missing year number was probably Amenemnisu. When we are humble, we will acknowledge that there are possibly an infinite number of reasons we could invoke to explain a feast day five falling on New Year's Day. Or, the fifth day of the feast, it says, was the new year, it says, in the inscription itself, as we read in sentence number one there. It was the fifth day of the feast. So why did I say the fourth day of the feast? Oh yeah, the fifth epagamenal day was the fourth of the feast. The last day of the year, right. So the fifth day of the feast, which was a feast of Ammon, in other words, a lunar feast of the new moon. So lunar day 1 was the first day of the feast. Lunar day 5 was the fifth day and the last day of the feast. So this day five fell on New Year's Day, according to this inscription. A very unusual, or, you know, rather unique circumstance. So we could think of maybe the number of reasons we could invoke is infinite as to how that came about, or it might be that Epagomenal day two of that Epagomenal month of 5 days was lunar day one, May 18th, 1086. 1086, May 18th is lunar day one here, Epagomenal two, right here in our LEAP application on our webpage, Will of Jehovah. So therefore, if we count, we can count Epagomenal the next day, right? Lunar day two, Epagomenal three, that is. And then the next day is lunar day three, Epagomenal four, Epagomenal. And then the next day is lunar day four, Epagomenal five. And the very next day is the new year, lunar day five, new year, Thoth one. The first day of the Egyptian calendar year, Thoth 1, falls on lunar day 5 in 1086 BCE. And that's not only true in this calculator, it's also true in our chronology. That's year 4 of Amenemniso, because his year 1, we have, well, Smendes ruled 26 years from 1115, right? So the year 1 of Amenemnisu is 1089, right? 26 years after. I guess I should show the math just for 1115, just for convenience, minus 26 is 1089. That's year one of Amenemnisu, who succeeded Smendes. Okay. So therefore, 1086 is year 4, isn't it? 3 years after, depending on when he exceeded in 1089, it could be year 4. So that's remarkable, you know, or maybe it's, of course, maybe it's year 3. It just had to be a low year number, right? So, I mean, you know, if he exceeded after May 18th, or after that time of year, in the year 1089, it would be still year 3, but it would still be a low year number. So what are the odds of the year number being between 1 to 5 here? Well, Epagomenal 2 falls on lunar day 1 every 25 years. So in the Egyptian calendar, basically you can go 25 years up or down and you could arrive at that again. But that's a 1 in 25 probability of it happening by pure chance. Right? 1 in 25. But then, if we're allowed to have years 1, 2, 3, or 4, then 25 divided by 4 is about 6, right? So it's like there's 4 chances in 25 would be about 1 in 6 of it happening by chance alone. Or if we allow year 5 as a possibility also, then it's 25 divided by 5, it's about 1 in 5. 1 in 5 probability. Right? So this is a brilliant thing that we discovered here from the banishment stela, because it means, well, we have so many proofs already, but it's another proof of our chronology, but it's an astounding proof, isn't it? It really is. Because there's only a 1 in 6 chance or 1 in 5 chance that it happens just by chance. And yet, it lined up perfectly there. We'd have to go 25 years away for it to happen again. And we, in the Crucible article, had left Amenemnisu completely out of our chronology. We didn't even have him in there, so we could have missed this. But also, we just mentioned the rarity of specificity is making this alignment 1 in 6 as believable to have occurred by chance alone. Therefore, radiocarbon to conclude our chapter, and archaeometric logic go hand in hand. That is, radiocarbon and archaeometric logic go hand in hand and are not separable, as God shows in our blessed genealogy. This might be comparable to attempts to force religion into a box, although it makes no partial distinctions. That last statement is simply a statement of providing food for thought. The reference was from James 3 and 17, so we should perhaps look that up, James 3 and 17. By the way, this is Carte du Ciel, Sky Chart version 4, showing 1086, May 17th, the last day of visibility, one day before Lunar Day 1, showing about 10 degrees of altitude and about 11 degrees of azimuth from Thebes for the moon's visibility here. And of course, but by the way, I didn't show already, but Gauchy has already calculated this as well in her tables for the last day of visibility at Thebes. She has May 17th in 1086 BCE, right there. Negative 1085 scientific notation for 1086 BCE. That's May 17th, last visibility, and she has conjunction sort of around midday on the 18th of May, which is not too different from what we had. If we go back, yeah, let's find out where, here it is. Local time is about, well, it's later local time, but we have to add 3 hours to the time that she gave, which was universal time, Greenwich time. But we have about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, Egyptian time, for that new moon on the 18th. So that's what we've got. It's in wonderful agreement. Again, proving our chronology once more, as if we needed any more proof, as if we could have imagined any better proof than what we already had. And yet we've got this as well. This year, in year 3 or 4 of Amenemhesu, but the point is, this Feast of Ammon, with the fifth day of the feast falling on Egyptian New Year's Day, Thoth 1. Fabulous. So, in our studies upcoming, we have Chapter 10, where we're going to study the radiocarbon according to White Law, a chapter entitled White Law on Real Life Deluge, attested in radiocarbon study. White Law did research where he looked at the radiocarbon measurements, all the radiocarbon dates that had ever been taken and that had ever been published. He looked at all of those and he searched through them all to see what he could learn. And, well, there's a little table here, what he got. Let's see, make it smaller. This is not from White Law, but this is an example of what. I don't think this came from White Law himself. I think, but he's got other things. He's got a graph. But this came from another gentleman who had a very similar date to the deluge as what we had. His date for the deluge was about 5,000 years ago, as indicated by this. So that's about what we have, which is, We have about 5,500 years ago, I guess, right? Yeah. But you see here, in this graph, this was this from White Law? I'm not sure. I think there was another gentleman who did this, who presented this chart. It was, I didn't get it. I got it from a different website anyway. I don't think I got it from one of White Law's articles, but wait a minute. I probably say right in the article. No, this is from White Law. Yeah. This is from White Law. Okay, this chart is from White Law. Okay, because there was another, Mr. Uman, I think his name was, the other man from whom I got information. So this was from White Law. So look at this. You see this? Incredibly. The radiocarbon dates that had been done, there are more of them before 5,500, or before, yeah, and after 5,500, before the present, or, well, we could say before 1950, 5,000 years before 1950, right? It's not 55 then, it's 5,400 and something or whatever, but, you know, there were a huge number of radiocarbon around 5,000 years ago, which is close, within 500 years of where we date the deluge, and this is a very approximate type of graph. You can see on this graph, it's from, can you not? Well, I'm going to explain it though. The amount of radiocarbon measurements that were observed prior to 6,000 years ago, or before present, which would be before 1950, I guess, because that's how they do radiocarbon, is always before 1950. That's 1950 is considered as the present. But anyway, more than 6,000 years before present, there are about 600 measurements. Plus, and then the year just prior, or the grouping, which is about 500 year increments, the next 500 years, in the 500 years just prior to 6,000 years before present, there were 100 or so radiocarbon measurements for that time period. Then there were 200, and then there were 300. And so it was rising. It was rising 100, 200, 300 up to the year, approximately the year 5,500 or something. Okay, which is our deluge. And then they suddenly dropped off after that. And so the number of measurements obtained from the time after 5,500, it went way down below 100 measurements, and then it slowly began to rise again. It hadn't even reached 200 by the time of Christ. Or, sorry, by the time of present. By the time of 1950. By 1950 of our common era, it still was only back to 200 measurements. This is the number of measurements per year or something, or the number, yeah. It's something that's quantifiable. So look at this. So you see that? So it shows that the number, it went way up to 300 per year from that time period before the deluge, and after the deluge it dropped down to 20 per year, and then slowly rose back to 150 per year in 1950. That was for tree deaths alone. The animals also saw an increase to over 200 before the flood. And then after the flood, they went way down to 10 or 20 measurements per year of that time period. Then rose gradually up to 522. And then 716. Sort of 1,000 years or 1,500 years before 1950. Okay. But it took a long time to rise up. It gradually rose from 10 to 500. It took, you know, 3,000 years to do that, to get back up there. The number of radiocarbon measurements per year that corresponded to the age, the corresponding age of the radiocarbon measurement, right? So that it shows it dropped off rapidly, suddenly, dropped off at the flood. It was over 200, dropped to 10. That was for men and animals, the men and animals measurements of radiocarbon. And that was in North and South America. Then in Afro-Eurasia, the flood, again, it was rising to over 300 measurements per year before the flood. After the flood, dropped to about 40 or 50 measurements per year, then rose again to maybe 150 in the next 500 years after that. So 1,000 years after the deluge, it had gotten back to about 150 or 200 measurements per year, but it was over 300 before the flood. This is for Afro-Eurasia. And then it gradually kept rising again, the number of measurements found in those 500-year intervals. And then it reached a peak, started dropping off. Well, they weren't testing or doing a lot of radiocarbon on men and animals in the hundreds of years after, in the years, in the centuries after Christ, for example, after the turn of the Common Era, as we call it, which is 2,000 years approximately before present. After that time, men and animals in Afro-Eurasia drops off again, somewhat. It never gets back to the level it was before the flood. It only reaches about 350 or something, where it was higher than that before the flood, 375. So the number of measurements per year of radiocarbon can be used as an indicator, which is what Whitelaw did. He used it as proof of the deluge, and what the date of the deluge was can be seen from that as well. So that's what we're going to be studying tomorrow. He was a creationist. He believed in creation, but he was a nuclear physicist as well. He believed in creation by God. Okay, so that's today's study. And, I've gathered more publications. Let me talk about it anyway and talk about how many publications I've been gathering. It's not going to be that entirely useful, I'm sure, because it's just time we have. Let's see. We've got, today alone, I've got 27 new files, some of which are just illustrations. I'm going to show some of these illustrations. Yeah, let's show some of the illustrations. That's what we want to do here. That's the Aegean phases of pottery. That's not within our great interest range. Oh, yeah, here's where I made a graph yesterday where I showed from row 14 here, the end of Iron 2A was given in this 2015 paper by Fantelkin, Alexander Fantelkin, called Late Helladic to Middle Geometric Aegean and Contemporary Cypriot Chronologies, which was with Finkelstein and Piasecki as well as co-authors. Alexander Fantelkin showed in Table 3 on page 38 of this article, it was from BASOR, that publication, the acronym BASOR. Okay, and here in column 14, the transitional time for the end of Iron 2A was given here. And it was given for the general Levant model of Finkelstein and his associates, which is, in this case, 785 to 748. And in the case of this particular article, it was determined as 869 to 752 for that transition. But, of course, in this article, they didn't have as many measurements, so the 869 was a lot more it was more inaccurate for the upper limit. And in the footnote here, the starting dates for these transitions are less constrained than in the general Levant model, because the latter has more data. But the end date, that was what I used for my graph, 748, 752. So let's look at the inverted graph. I want the Oh, there's another good... There's a great graph I want to show you there. That was not the one I wanted to show you. It's the one... This one. Right. That's strange. I don't understand it. Yeah, oh, I get it now, yeah. This is the graph that I updated. Yeah. So, I added this new line around 750, end of iron 2A, according to Fantalcon 2015, table 3, row 14, page 38 of that article. 750 is where he puts that, the end of 2A. So when you look at this graph now, the middle of iron 2A is right here. It's almost exactly in the middle of the time of Shishak 973 and 750. We have 973 and 750. That's about 220 years and 112 years different between 865, or it was 115 years different. Yeah, between 865, the average of the middle of Iron 2A, of all the data that Mazar gave us in 2008, that average 865 compared to 750 is 115 years different. Right? So it's very symmetrical. The end, so if this is the end of iron 2A and 750, that maybe that's good. It's correct, because in our chronology, Shishak is the end of iron 1 and thus the beginning of iron 2A. So the symmetry here is what I wanted to point out in our graph. And that was from this, because in the one case it was 748 and here it was 752 for the end of this transition of iron, which is the transition at the end of iron 2A. So 750 was the average of 748 and 752. That's where I got that from. Look at this other amazing article. Finkelstein, Mr. Israel, here, in this remarkable article called From 2009, Radiocarbon Dated Destruction Layers, a Skeleton. In figure 6, you see the western sites in Israel, Megiddo, Kaysan, and Yokneam. The dating is around 2850. Now, in our chronology, we need the end of Iron 1 to be 2820 in order for it to agree with our chronology, and these are just about within range. Certainly if that's one standard deviation, they're definitely within range of our date 973. Then you look at the eastern sites in this graph by Mr. Finkelstein again, figure 6 of that article. I want to keep tabs on the time, we must be running out. Yeah, there we go. And the eastern, have a few minutes, eastern sites here, Hadar and Rehov, he's got just a little bit below 2800, and some of them agree with 2820 here. Hadar does, and so does Hema. Hema's the other one. And Dor, look at Dor. Dor, oh, I found another thing for Dor. I want to show you this. I found a different... result from Dor that totally agrees with our chronology by Huygens. So anyway, you see how these results all agree in this publication by Mr. Finkelstein. They all are compatible. On average, certainly, they're compatible here with 2820, which is roughly our date for Shishak. 973 falls right in there somewhere. It's very, very good to show how the data that Mr. Finkelstein presents agrees with our chronology so well. And also, Graham Huygens from 2006, in his article called Testing the Limits, he's got a date from Dor, and we know it's from this phase of the destruction layer at Dor. B1/12-G/9 is the destruction layer at Dor that is the obvious end of that phase by a major destruction at that city of Dor. And here we've got 900 is here, just slightly off the peak. 1,000 is here, slightly to the left of the peak. So 973 would be right in the middle of that peak. It's called 2806 plus or minus 69 here, with a 95% probability between 1160 and 810. But we're interested in 973 is about 160 years above 810. 973 is about 190 years below 1160, but we're just about in the middle of the range here, 973. So this at Dor, therefore, we can see how the radiocarbon for the destruction layer at Dor exactly agrees, regardless of the pottery phase. It proves that, once again, our chronology is either perfectly right or is, you know, what else could it be? Like, I mean, it's hard to know what else it could be. And then, there's a great article by Manning I want to show you. I want to get the Manning article up here. Manning is the only person who's done the absolute age range of the late Cypriot 2C, it seems like. And he did it and got a number. And some of his results are even lower in date than 1180 or 1200. But he ended up deciding that where are his conclusions at the very end? Here it is. He says, okay, let's get it bigger. We got time. We're out of time. Look at this. He says he proposes an absolute age range for the main LC2C, which is roughly corresponds, you know, to LH3C. But from 1340, 1315 to 1200 for the 2C. So that the next period of the late Cypriot corresponds to the 3C, is what I should say, of the late Helladic 3C, which is conventionally 1200. So this ends about 1200 for the Cypriot pottery as well. That's what he concludes here for late Cypriot 2C, which, of course, anyway, we just don't have time to cover more, but August 11th, 2024 of the Common Era is the time. 2030 hours is the Eastern Daylight Time, North American time, and I'm Ward Green. I love you very much. Thank you for listening and watching. In my behalf, this is Liv Dusty, and this is Cassie saying bye for now.